Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Hadabarnix. Shalom Talmidim students. Good to have you here for the next session of the Minor Prophets, the 12 Minor Prophets. Currently, we are studying the book of Hosea, and this is session number 5 of Hosea. We're working through material provided by Ariel Ministries. So let's have a quick overview, a quick review of where we were last session. Last session, I gave you a quick overview of the Abrahamic Covenant. The Abrahamic Covenant is an eternal and unilateral covenant that God made with the Jewish people, consisting of three basic promises: a land promise, a national promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. Now, the three promises of the Abrahamic Covenant are expanded and developed by three additional eternal and unilateral covenants God made with the Jewish people: the land promise, expanded and developed by the land covenant; the national promise, expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant; and the spiritual blessing promise, expanded and developed by the new covenant. As far as the time frames of Hosea, last session we were in the Lo Ami period, extending from the Messiah's first coming until the tribulation period, or through the tribulation period, in verses 8 and 9, a period of time, a temporary period of time, when the Jewish people are called not my people. Then we moved into the kingdom period, chapter 1, verse 10 to chapter 2, verse 1. And that's the situation we left last week, last time, last session. Then I referred you to this chart, God's relationship with Israel, that's available in your Hosea handouts PDF. And this is a very, very important chart because it summarizes the first chapter, the very, very first and very, very important first chapter of Hosea. So let's run through this chart real quickly once again. In chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, God's relationship with Israel is illustrated by harlotry. Hosea's wife, Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, the perfect daughter of pleasure, married Hosea and then turned to prostitution. So the physical wife had turned to physical adultery and prostitution, just as the spiritual wife, the Lord, of the Lord, Israel, had turned to spiritual adultery and prostitution. So Hosea's family members represent what's going on in the life of the nation Israel. All right, in verses 3 through 5, God's relationship with Israel is judgment. Represented by Hosea's firstborn son, Jezreel, the nation will be scattered. In verses 6 and 7, God's relationship is aloofness. Represented by Hosea's daughter, Lo-Ruhamah, not pitied, the nation would be destroyed by the Assyrians. And verses 8 and 9, God's relationship with Israel is rejection, portrayed by Hosea's second son, Lo-Ami, not my people. For a period of time, the Jewish people will be known as not my people. Now everything changes. When we get to verse 10, everything flips over to the other direction. In verse 10, the illustration of God's relationship with Israel is acceptance. Again, Hosea's second son, his name is changed from Lo-Ami to Ami, from not my people to my people. In verse 11, God's relationship with Israel is compassion, portrayed by Hosea's daughter, Ruhamah. Her name originally was Lo-Ruhamah. It is now Ruhamah, from not pitied to pitied. And then, in verse 11 through chapter 2, verse 1, God's relationship with Israel is that of blessing, portrayed by Hosea's firstborn son, Jezreel. Instead of being scattered, the nation will now be sown. Very important chart that outlines God's relationship with Israel from the distant past through the tribulation period and on into the kingdom. This is the whole sweep of Israel's history in just one chapter. It's a very, very important chapter. You should master this material. Well, then we wanted to take a little side trip and look at the beginning of the Lo Ami Lo Ruhamah period. When did it begin? And to do that, we had to look at Matthew 12, 22 through 46. And I gave you an outline in the Hosea handouts to follow. We saw that the Messiahship of Yeshua was rejected. The Messiah defended himself on 4 points. And then he issued judgment on that generation. Well, the rabbis tried to take the offensive back, and they requested a sign, and the request for a sign was refused. No sign would be given Israel except one, the sign of the prophet Jonah, the sign of resurrection. And then Yeshua closed by teaching about new spiritual ties. He prioritized spiritual relationships above physical relationships. And this is exactly when the low Ami period began, because it began with the rejection of his messiahship in Matthew chapter 12. But then we said there is an end to the Lo Ami Lo Ruchama period, and that's found in Romans 11, 25 through 36, when all Israel shall be saved. We discussed the unpardonable sin as we went through chapter 12 of the book of Matthew, and that's worth going over because this is such a unsettling doctrine that many Christians worry over. So we'll quickly go through the unpardonable sin again. First of all, the definition I give you will be derived from the context. From the context. Here's the definition. The unpardonable sin is the national rejection of the messiahship of Yeshua while he was physically present on the grounds that he was demon-possessed. That's the best definition of the unpardonable sin. The extent of the unpardonable sin. A, it's a national sin. It's not an individual sin. B, it's unique to the generation of Yeshua's day. It cannot be committed today. C, a physical judgment is set against that generation of the nation, that generation. The physical judgment cannot be alleviated. It is unpardonable. The physical judgment on that generation, on the nation, is the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. Jerusalem and the temple were doomed from that moment on. And so the unpardonable sin has come and gone, folks. It cannot be committed today, and Israel is not under it today. It has come and gone. However, you'll run across a number of unbiblical positions regarding the unpardonable sin that cause nothing but anxiety in the Christian world. Why? Because these positions are taken out of context. Now, here's one of them, and I'm sure there are many. I don't say this is an exhaustive example of in any way, shape, or form. But let me just read you one of the positions that I've encountered. The commentator says, blasphemy against the Holy Spirit is committed by a Christian. In other words, you can commit the unpardonable sin today. Well, what is the unpardonable sin? Well, they really don't know because they take it out of context. So there's all kinds of opinions as to what the unpardonable sin might be. Nobody seems to know. So here's their stab at it. This is equivalent either to, so they don't know what it is, so they're going to offer a couple of opinions. This is equivalent either to apostasy or to rejection of a Christian prophet's inspired message. And the penalty? For this, there is no forgiveness. In other words, you've lost your salvation. That's it. No way you can be saved. You've lost your forgiveness. So Stendhal, Peake, Boring, some other commentators. Well, I am totally in opposition to that kind of a view of the unpardonable sin. It has caused nothing but anxiety and grief in many people's lives. I am convinced that once you are saved, you are always saved. That justification is a one-time event that's permanent. And there's many, many verses that support this. I'm going to share with you just one. John 10, 27 and 28. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. I give eternal life to them. Eternal means exactly that. Eternal. It doesn't mean temporary life that you're going to have for a million years and then lose. That's temporary life, you guys. This is eternal life for the ages upon ages upon ages without end. And this is emphasized by the Messiah's next phrase, and they will never perish. Never perish. That means your salvation is secure. And nobody can cause you to perish either. Nobody can take you away from salvation. That's the final phrase. And no one will snatch them out of my hand. You are secure, believer in Yeshua. You are secure. Then I wanted to quickly go over the sign of the prophet Jonah, the sign of resurrection. This final sign will come to Israel on four occasions. It came with the resurrection of Lazarus in John 11. It came with the resurrection of the recently deceased believers in Matthew 27, 52 and 53. It came with the resurrection of Yeshua, Matthew 28, Mark 16, Luke 24, John 10. Now, excuse me, John 20. And there's one more instance in the future to come. It will come with the resurrection of the two witnesses during the tribulation period, Revelation 11. These days, we don't practice signs to Israel. We give them the gospel. We present Christ crucified, Yeshua, Messiah, crucified. All right, now this chart, this is a new chart for you. It's entitled Hosea's Ministry, and it can be found in your Hosea handouts PDF on page 5. But let me go over a couple of key areas with this chart with you. Okay, at the beginning of Hosea's ministry, now Hosea's ministry is on the far right column. Hosea began his ministry during the reigns of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Jeroboam II, king of Israel. Now he prophesied the ending of Jehu's dynasty, and in 753 Zechariah was deposed. He was the last king of Jehu's dynasty, and so the prophecy was fulfilled. And so this is a short-term prophecy authenticating Hosea. He uttered this prophecy. It was verifiable. It came to pass. And then God began to scatter the nation, and so the political scene was chaos following the Jehu's dynasty. Shalom, Mechnachem, Pekahiah, Pekah all came and went as kings of Israel. And then, under the reign of Ahaz, king of Judah, and the final king of Israel, Hoshea, the northern kingdom was destroyed by Assyria. And again, this was a short-term prophecy that Hosea uttered, and it authenticated him. It came to pass during his lifetime in exactly the way he predicted. And then, under the reign of Hezekiah, Hosea's ministry came to a close. So there's a quick view of the prophet Hosea. All right. Now, we're going to jump back to Hosea's present day. Remember our time frame? We're in the kingdom. We just finished up looking at the kingdom, a glance at the kingdom in chapter 2, verse 1. Now, we're going to jump from the kingdom all the way back to the prophet's present time in chapter 2, verse 2. So we're jumping back thousands of years on the time frame. And as we do, we're going to look at Israel as the wife of the Lord. And we begin by looking at the adultery of Israel in verses 2 through 5. The charge of adultery comes forth in chapter 2, verse 2. Contend with your mother. Contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. So the adultery resulted in a separation between Hosea and his wife. And so Hosea talks to the children. Contend with your mother, children. Plead my cause against your mother. See, after the marriage, Gomer commits adultery, gets involved with prostitution. And he even asks the kids to plead with the mom to stop behaving this way. Because the results of her adultery, she's not my wife, I'm not her husband. A divorce. And the Sanchino Books of the Bible has some nice comments to say about verse 2. The Sanchino commentary says, as adultery, that's in the physical realm with marriage, as adultery destroys the marriage bond, the physical marriage bond, so idolatry severs the intimate relationship between God and Israel. So physical adultery destroys the relationship between husband and wife. Spiritual adultery, idolatry, severs the relationship between God and Israel. And this is exactly what other prophets have stated. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 1. This is Isaiah speaking to the southern kingdom. Thus says the Lord, where is the certificate of divorce by which I have sent your mother away? Or to whom of my creditors did I sell you? And now comes the answer. Behold, you were sold for your iniquities and for your transgression, your mother was sent away. Jeremiah had the same message. And again, this is to the southern kingdom. And I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, that's the northern kingdom, I had sent her away and given her a writ of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but she went and was a harlot also. So you see the picture here, the women being physical harlots, portraying Israel being spiritual harlots. Let's move on. So the results, let's talk about that necessity of putting her away for adultery. You know, God divorces the northern king, northern kingdom. That's Hosea's message to the nation. God is going to divorce you. And that put away, that term put away, is used a putting away of idolatry. We've got four examples on your outline. Let's take a look at the first two. Genesis 35:2. This is way back in the time of Jacob, the patriarch. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods who are among you and purify yourselves and change your garments. And then in Joshua's day, Joshua 24:14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. And so Israel has been characterized by idol worship, idolatry, for many, many, many centuries, since the very beginning, since even Jacob's day. That's unfortunately the story of the nation. Okay, at this point, God tells Israel how he will discipline her in the near future. So we move from chapter 2, verse 2, to chapter 2, verse 3 through 13, and we're moving forward into the Assyrian destruction in 722 BC. This is how I'm going to discipline you if you keep up this behavior. Hosea chapter 2, verse 3, I will put her away. I tell her to put away her adultery, or I will strip her naked and expose her as on the day when she was born. I will also make her like a wilderness and make her like a desert land, and slay her with thirst. So he says, I will strip her naked and expose her on the day in which she was born. He will send her out in this condition as a mark of her adultery. Ezekiel 16, 38 and 39 carries the same idea. Thus I will judge you like women who commit adultery or shed blood are judged. And I will bring on you the blood of wrath and jealousy. I will also give you into the hands of your lovers, and they will tear down your shrines and demolish your high places and strip you of your clothing. That's the way women convicted of adultery were treated. Take away your jewels and will leave you naked and bare. Okay, now that's the condition that God found the nation. That was the state he found her in when she was born. And that's Ezekiel 16, 3 through 6. Here's how God found her. The idea here, the picture here, is an unwanted child, an unwanted newborn. And this is quite a dramatic description of how God picked up the nation and began to give her life. Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth are from the land of the Canaanite. Your father was an Amorite, your mother a Hittite. As for your birth, this is the nation of Israel. On the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water for cleansing. You were not rubbed with salt or even wrapped in cloths. So all the basic baby care stuff was not done to this child. Instead, what was done to the child? No eye looked with pity on you to do any of these things for you, to have compassion on you. Rather, you were thrown out into the open field, for you abhorred on the day you were born. So this is a newborn, just taken out into the field and dumped without any care at all, without any care, expecting the baby to die. But a passerby comes by, and that's the picture of the Lord. When I passed by you and saw you squirming in your blood, I said to you while you were in your blood, live. Yes, I said to you while you were in your blood, live. And so God had compassion on this unwanted baby, and he took her into his arms, and he caused her to live. That was the state in which he found her. But now he's going to return her to that state. How? Here's the results of the stripping. Wilderness. The land will be depopulated. The land will be a dry land, a desert. So the land will be barren and depopulated. Thirst will characterize the land. The people will die of thirst. And these are all judgments of the Mosaic Law. So that's the first result of not my people, lo ami. The second result is there'll be no mercy upon the nation in verses 4 and 5. Also, I will have no compassion on her children because they are children of harlotry, for their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who gave me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. So he's not going to have any mercy on the children. These are the individuals within the nation. They were the children of harlotry. And the reason, of course, is the adultery of the mother of the nation. Gomer had become an adulterer and a prostitute, just as the nation had become a spiritual adulterer and prostitute. And the misconception of Gomer, paralleled by the nation, other gods provided for her the good things she experienced. You know, the golden calf did, the Baal did, etc., etc. Not the Lord. Not the Lord. So the response of the Lord is to hedge in Israel in verses 6 through 8. So the hedge comes into view in verse 6. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. So this is very emphatic. Therefore, for this reason. Now, the hedge is always used with a good connotation. It is a protective element with a good purpose. For example, Job 1:10. Here, Satan is arguing with God about God's blessing upon Job. Satan says, have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. So the hedge here is carries with it an element of blessing and protection. So this is there for a good purpose. And the good result is in verse 7. She will pursue her lovers, and she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but will not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. So the hedging in obstructs Israel's pursuit. She's caged, and she's put into a cage of thorns. And so she won't find her other lovers. She won't find the other gods. They will prove to be non-entities. They won't be able to help her. So she'll pursue and chase after adultery. She's going to come up empty-handed. And then she will see her need and return to her first husband. And you know, that's very, very, this hedging in is very, very typical of God's attitude. He goes after the sinner in love, doesn't he? And a good example of that is Luke chapter 15. And God's attitude is portrayed in Luke 15 beautifully. In Luke 15, 1 through 7, we have the lost sheep, the story of the lost sheep. And in that story, there's active searching after the sheep. In Luke 15, 8 through 10, that's about a lost coin. And there's active searching, going after a lost coin. And then Luke in 15, 11 through 32, there's a lost son. And now there's a passive waiting and yearning and watching for the wayward to come home. And that's exactly the way God feels about Israel and Gomer and you and I. He will actively seek us out to bring us back. All right, let's take a look at verse 8 now. The reason for her behavior is verse 8. For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain and the new wine and the oil and lavished on her silver and gold, which they use for Baal. So this is a failure to recognize the true source of the material benefits. They use the gifts of God for idolatry, for the worship of Baal. And this provides a key theme for Hosea. The lack of knowledge results in destruction. And this appears a number of times in the book of Hosea. When we get to chapter 4, verse 6, we'll get to a critical instance of this lack of knowledge, because here we will learn that this lack of knowledge is a deliberate reaction. It isn't just an accident that happened to fall upon Gomer and happened to fall upon the nation. They were victims. It wasn't that at all. It was deliberate rejection of the knowledge of God. And so the result is the stripping of Israel in chapter 2, verses 9 through 13. First of all, the stripping of the food and the clothing. Chapter 2, verse 9. Therefore, I will take back my grain at harvest time and my new wine in its season. I will also take away my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. So the necessities of life are removed, and God is being very emphatic once again. Next result, nakedness in verse 10. And then I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. So the nation is going to be totally vulnerable and humiliated. Third point, there will be a cessation of joy, mirth, and festivals in verse 11. I will also put an end to all her gaiety. All that joy and rejoicing is gone. I'll put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies. Now, these were the festivals ordained and required by the Mosaic Law. Point A, the feasts. The feasts are the Passover, Pesach, Pentecost, Shavuot, Tabernacles, Sukkot. These were the yearly festivals. But there were monthly festivals as well, the New Moon Festival. You see, Israel and the Bible operates around a lunar calendar. And so each month you had a very significant day, the day of the new moon. Now, you may not be familiar with the New Moon Festival. So I provided a short article for you on the Hosea Handouts PDF, page 6. You'll find a short article on the new moon. The third festival is the Sabbath, Shabbat. This is the weekly day of rest. We've got the yearly festival, the monthly festival, now the weekly day of rest. And then D, solemn assemblies. And there's a spelling error there. It's not Solomon assemblies. It's solemn assemblies, S-O-L-E-M-N. S-O-L-E-M-N, solemn assemblies, serious assemblies. These would be Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But all these festivals were used for the worship of Baal rather than the Lord. So Israel followed the Mosaic Law, but she followed it very, very improperly, using it for idol worship. Finally, I shouldn't say finally, next there'll be a removal of security in verse 12. I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them. So the vine and the fig tree, those are symbols of security and peace and prosperity. For example, 1 Kings 4:25. So Judah and Israel lived in safety. And how is that portrayed? Every man under his vine and his fig tree. Security and prosperity. From Dan even to Beersheba, from the north all the way to the south, all the days of Solomon, the 40 years that Solomon was king over the country. They lived under their vine and fig tree in security and prosperity. But the nation assumed that these gifts were gifts of her lovers, but now they're going to be taken away. And there will be judgment upon these days, the days of the Baalim in verse 13. I will punish her for the days of the Baals when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. So the days of the Balaim were the days of the proper Mosaic feasts used in an improper way for the worship of Baal. And all this resulted in the forgetting of her husband, the Lord. And again, the Lord is being very, very emphatic here. He says, declares the Lord. The Hebrew there is Ne'um Adonai. Ne'um Adonai. A Ne'um is a solemn, solemn declaration. All right, now we come to a time of drashing, some practical application. And this handout, I have a handout for you on page 7 of your Hosea Handouts PDF. And so this is an application chart, a theme and application chart. So as we look through these first chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 13, how can this apply to our lives today? Well, let's first of all look at the theme that I think was prevalent in these chapters. The basic overall theme would be this: God's loving response to Israel, to Gomer, and to us. This is God's loving way. God doesn't hate us, folks. God loves his people. This is God's loving way of dealing with man, with those who trust in him, or even those who used to trust in him and turn their back, like Gomer. So the application: Gomer's sin and punishment and restoration illustrate the life of the nation Israel. Gomer was a perfect daughter of pleasure, sensually. She was adulterous and a prostitute. She was a perfect daughter of pleasure materialistically. She loved the food and the water and the wine and the linen and the oil and the drink. It also applied economically. She loved the silver and the gold, and she loved religiosity, but she loved Baal and not the Lord. So that was this is what's happening in the nation. But you know, a nation is made up of individuals. She, Gomer, was typical of the people that made up the nation. You know, in her day, she was just a typical Israeli. And so illustrated the basic attitudes of Israel at this time. That's why she was chosen. God had to chastise Gomer and Israel in love. I want to emphasize that, in love, for their own good, by rebuke, by blocking, by walling in, and by stripping. He was chastising her in love. But now, let's get specific to our own lives. Let's not point a finger at Israel and say, tisk, 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 because when you point your finger at somebody, you got three more pointing back at you. So let's look at ourselves. Let's ask ourselves some questions. Is there some pleasure in the world that I am chasing, that you are chasing after, and turning my back, turning your back on God? Could it be sensual? Could we be chasing after entertainment or literature that's sensual? Could we be chasing after the materialistic things of this world? Food, home, car, clothes? Are we lusting after the economics of this world? Money, career, education, that kind of thing. And finally, do we like religion? Do we like religion? We love it. Are we ignoring and rejecting God and in place worshiping a subtle idol of some sort? An idol is anything that comes before God in your life. Sensual, economic, whatever, materialistic, you know, religious, you know, whatever. All kinds of idols can come between you and God. So what's God's plan of action? God has a plan of action, and he'll follow that to win you back to himself in love, in order of severity. You start out by rebuking, then he gets a little tougher by blocking, then walling in, and finally, if you're still rushing after your idols, he'll strip you down so that you'll come back to him. So the question we need to ask ourselves is, what could you do? What could I do to cooperate with God and rid ourselves of this idolatrous desire before God has to implement his hands and bring us back to himself? What could we do? Spend a few moments thinking about that and praying about that. Just pause the DVD. Just pause the YouTube. And ask God, God, what can I do? Am I lusting after some idol? What can I do to come back to you? All right, I'll leave that up to you. We now move into the distant future. We were in the near future. What God will do to the northern kingdom in order to bring the northern kingdom back to him. But now he moves into the tribulation period in verses 14 and 15. And now we look at that restoration of the wife in the final sense, the final sense. We come to the courtship in verses 14 and 15. This is the tribulation period. We begin with the wooing in the wilderness, and the wilderness is Bozra. And this sentence is very, very emphatic. God says, therefore. It's very definite. He's very insistent. Therefore, behold, I will allure her. Bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her. Okay? Now, let me read a comment by the Artful Tanakh commentary. And I think this is a very enlightening and comment regarding this wooing in the wilderness that we've just read about. The commentator says, the sage's comment, Rabbi Berechiah said in the name of Rabbi Levi, like the first Redeemer, shall be the final Redeemer. A first Redeemer and a final Redeemer? Two Redeemers. The first Redeemer appeared to them and then was hidden from them. So shall be the final Redeemer. Interesting. Redeemer comes, he's hidden, and then a Redeemer comes. Sounds kind of like the ministry of Yeshua, doesn't it? And this is called the obscuration of the Messiah. To where will he lead them? Some say to the wilderness of Judah. Some say to the wilderness of Sihon and Og. This is what is written. Behold, I will seduce her and I will lead her to the wilderness. So the rabbis agree that she's going to be literally taken out into the wilderness. Now let me explain the wooing in the wilderness to you in summary. Now this is found on your handout on pages 8 and 9 of your Hosea handouts page. Page 8 and 9, the wooing in the wilderness. Here's a summary. In the middle of the tribulation period, the majority of the Jewish people will flee persecution by the Antichrist by going to a location outside of Israel that is a mountainous wilderness, Basra/Petra, in the Mount Seir mountain range that's in southern Jordan. Once there, God will court Israel, woo Israel, and Israel will respond. And there's a number of verses that deal with the wooing in the wilderness. Now, what we're talking about here is the campaign of Armageddon. That's what's in view here. Now, this is not a study of the campaign of Armageddon, so we're not going to go into this in detail. We're just going to give you an introduction to this campaign, and we're going to cover 8 of 11 stages of the campaign of Armageddon. That's because the material in Hosea only covers these 8 stages. So I'll give you a resource to go to if you want to study this in greater depth. So here's the campaign of Armageddon. There's the Middle East. We begin with point 1. The Antichrist's armies assemble at Armageddon. That's Har-Megiddo. Now where's that? That, folks, is the Jezreel Valley. Har-Megiddo, the mountain of Megiddo, overlooks the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley is very, very important in the book of Hosea, isn't it? And it's very, very important in the campaign of Armageddon as well. So all the nations of the world will send troops and military supplies to the Jezreel Valley. Now here's the Jezreel Valley today. As you can see, it's a broad, flat, plain, very fertile. A lot of room there. This whole valley, huge valley, will be crawling with soldiers and military equipment when all of it comes in. And notice in the middle of the picture, there's an Israel Air Force base there. And so the Antichrist will be able to bring in military supplies and soldiers by air. He'll also be able to bring them in by sea because Haifa, the port of Israel, is located at the western end of the Jezreel Valley. So land, sea, and air. The armies will assemble in the Jezreel Valley. Here's another view of it. And off in the distance, you can see Mount Tabor. And before us is the long, large, flat valley of the Jezreel. This is the staging area. No battle will be fought here. This is the staging area for the armies of the Antichrist. All right. Now, at this time in the tribulation period, Babylon will be the religious, political, and economic capital of the world. It'll be the Antichrist's world capital. And so we come to stage two of the campaign of Armageddon. The Antichrist joins his troops. So he will move due west to the Jezreel Valley. His headquarters will probably be located there on Har-Megiddo, overlooking his vast military machine. Now this will bring us to the third step, which is the destruction of Babylon. We learn in Jeremiah 51, 27 and 28 that the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, up in the upper right corner, and Ashkenaz in the upper left corner. Ashkenaz is Germany, so it's off the map here. Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz all join forces with the Medes and do a surprise attack upon Babylon. The Antichrist is not expecting this. The attack is very successful, and Babylon is vaporized. It's destroyed quickly and completely. Now, this brings us to the next stage, which is the fall of Jerusalem. The Antichrist has something bigger in mind than defending his capital. He wants to destroy the Jewish people and destroy Jerusalem. So in spite of this loss that he has suffered, he sends his vast military machine against Jerusalem. A horrendous battle occurs. And even though it's a formidable battle, Jerusalem falls. Jerusalem falls. That brings us to stage number five. The tribulation holocaust begins, the Jewish flight to Bozrah or Petra. This is the middle of the tribulation. The Antichrist takes the opportunity to desecrate the temple, and the Jewish people flee the land. And they go south, and they find a refuge in Bozrah or Petra in Edom. That's southern Jordan today, in the land of Edom. The Bozrah or Petra is located in the Mount Seir mountain range of southern Jordan. Here's a picture, just a small segment of the Mount Seir mountain range, a very, very formidable and challenging, desolate wilderness. Here is a map, a Google Eye view of what's going on. You see the Dead Sea to the north and the Gulf of Eilat to the south. Well, right between the two is the Mount Seir mountain range in southern Jordan. That's the location of it. And right here is Bozrah or Petra, right in the middle of that mountain range. Now, Bozrah is in the middle of a valley and surrounded by sheer cliffs. It's a very, very defendable position. That's why it was chosen in past history by various peoples to be a city. And the main entry into Bozrah is the Sikh. That's an entry canyon. And what it is a crack in the walls of the mountain range. And you walk through this crack in the walls. You can see the floor is all nicely cemented in for tourists these days. But can you imagine a squad of infantrymen could hold off an army? You can't get tanks in there. You can't get big howitzers and stuff like that in there. You've got to put foot soldiers in there. And the defenders are defended by solid rock. So the Antichrist is going to have his work cut out for him to try to get in to Bozrah. As you come to the end of the Sikh, you begin to see an amazing sight. You walk out of the Sikh and you're face to face with the treasury. Very impressive building carved out of the wall, carved out of the cliff. And it was supposed to be impressive. The Nabataeans deliberately did that to impress any visitor that came into their city for the first time. They would come face to face with the treasury. And here we're looking up at the treasury. A very, very, very impressive bit of carving indeed. Let's go inside. We'll go inside and turn around. And we're looking outside through the 25 to 30 foot high door. See that individual walking in the door? Say that individual is 5.5 feet tall. That makes that door 25 to 30 feet high. And as you look beyond the door, as you look out the door, what do you see? You see the cliff and the Sikh, the crack in the cliff that has allowed you to come into this very, very defendable valley. Now, we're going into the air here, and we're looking down on the Mount Seir mountain range in the area of Petra. And up at the top there, you can see the sheer cliffs, the mountains that surround this valley that make it very defensible. And down at the bottom of the picture, in the red circle, there's the treasury. Doesn't look so formidable from this view, does it? And perhaps you can see the little dots in the roadway. Those little dots are the people heading into downtown Bozrah. And here's a Google Eye view. Here is the Sikh, that twisting defile in the rocks that allows you into the city of Bozrah. The treasury is located right about here in this area. And then here we have the roadway, the main roadway going into downtown Bozrah. By the way, Bozrah is the Hebrew name, Petra is the Greek name. Bozrah means sheepfold, Petra means huge cliff rock. Both describe Bozrah very well. So there's the city as we see it. Now, you go into Bozrah, and you can visit it today, and you'll see enormous buildings carved out of the sheer walls. Look at this one. This one is called the Urn Tomb at Bozrah. And another one here, very impressive, is called the Deir, or the monastery. And if you look closely, you can see a little man right at the bottom of the page, right in the middle of the middle door. Look how tiny he is. That gives you an idea of the scope of this carving, this building out of a sheer cliff. Quite amazing, isn't it? Now, here's some verses that will substantiate all that I've mentioned to you. just quickly, we're going to substantiate the fact that the Jewish people will flee into the wilderness and into the mountains. Matthew 24, 15 and 16. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which is spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, so we're in the middle of the tribulation period here. The temple's been desecrated. The response of seeing that, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. So the Jewish people in the city must flee to the mountains. There's the first hint where they should go. Revelation 12:6, we learn that they will flee to the wilderness. Then the woman, Israel, fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,260 days. So there's a place in the mountains and the wilderness prepared by God for 3.5 years. Okay? And she goes there in chapter 12, verse 14. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman, that's Israel, so that she could fly into the wilderness to her place. Now, this does not mean that some kind of an air force is going to airlift the Jewish people. The wings of a great eagle are just a biblical figure of speech for rapidity in flight, you know, and not literal flying with wings, but flight away. Like, for example, out of the Exodus, we came out of Egypt on eagle's wings, where there was no air force to fly us out of Egypt. So this is rapidity in flight, in leaving. So she could fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So 3.5 years, she's in a place prepared for her by God. And Ezekiel repeats this, Ezekiel 20, 34 through 38. I will bring you out from the peoples and gather you from the lands where you are scattered with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out, and I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples. Now, the Bible teaches that there will be two worldwide regatherings of the Jewish people. The first one in unbelief in preparation for judgment, that judgment being the tribulation. The second one in faith in preparation for blessing, that blessing being the Messianic kingdom. Here in Ezekiel 20, we see the first worldwide regathering of the Jewish people. It is fulfilled today in the life of the nation Israel, because the nation is brought back in unbelief. They're brought back with wrath poured out. Out of wrath and for wrath. Out of the wrath of the Holocaust and for the wrath of the tribulation. First worldwide regathering. This is being fulfilled today. And then God says, I'm going to bring you into the wilderness of the peoples. There it is, in the middle of the tribulation period, the flight into the wilderness. So here we come to the sixth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. The armies of the Antichrist besiege Basra. So the Antichrist doesn't want any Jewish people to get away, so he sends his armies south, and his armies put a ring of fire around Basra. They bring the city under siege. And Ezekiel 20, 34 through 38 reiterates that. There in the wilderness, I will enter into judgment with you face to face, as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So I will enter into judgment with you, declares the Lord. Tribulation period. I will make you pass under the rod. I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. And I will purge from you the rebels and those who transgress against me. And we'll see this developed a little bit more later on. But there's the purpose for this wrath, to purge out rebels and transgressors. I will bring them out of the land where they sojourn, but they will not enter the land of Israel. Thus you will know that I am the Lord. All right, that takes care of the wooing in the wilderness in Basra. We get into verse 15 now, and Israel's response to the wooing in the wilderness. Verse 15. Then I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. So the valley of Achor, that means the valley of troubling. It was called the valley of troubling due to the sin of Achan in Joshua 7, 24 through 26. And this valley illustrates the trouble Israel will be in. She'll be in tribulation, the great tribulation. And here I'd like to read another comment from the Art Scroll Tanakh series on Hosea. The rabbis write, the sages hereby teach us that the final redemption will follow the format of the first one. And after the Messiah's first appearance, interesting, the Jewish people will undergo even greater suffering prior to being redeemed. And that's what exactly what will happen in the life of Israel. We've gone through terrible suffering when the Messiah was here the first time, but greater suffering is ahead, and the rabbis recognize that. The time of Jacob's trouble lies ahead of us, the tribulation period. However, the Valley of Trouble will become a door. In the past, it became a door, and it will become a door to new victory and conquest. In the past, Israel went out from there and conquered the Promised Land. And again, Achor will be a door of hope as Israel returns to the land. Isaiah 65, verses 9 and 10 emphasize this as well. I will bring forth offspring from Jacob, and an heir of my mountain from Judah. Even my chosen one shall inherit it. My servants will dwell there, will dwell in the land. Sharon, the Sharon plain, will be a pasture land for flocks, and the valley of Achor, a resting place for herds, for my people who seek me. And so there'll be blessing in the Messianic kingdom instead of troubling. The valley of Achor will be a door of hope. Literally, Petach Tikva. Petach Tikva. And if you're familiar with Israel, that's an early settlement in the modern state of Israel. It's a modern city east of Tel Aviv today. So that name has been added to a city here. A door of hope, Petach Tikva. Well, let's get back to the campaign of Armageddon. This trouble, the Valley of Achor, the siege of Basra, brings us to the seventh stage in the campaign of Armageddon, the national rejection, national regeneration of Israel. There, surrounded by the Antichrist, the siege about to succeed, as the Antichrist puts unbearable pressure on the Jewish people, our stubborn will is broken, and we finally start calling out for the Messiah to return and save us. We start calling out for Yeshua. This is exactly what Yeshua predicted in Matthew 23:37-39. Jerusalem, Jerusalem who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. There's the rejection of the Messiahship of Yeshua in Matthew chapter 12. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. That's the destruction of the temple. For I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. We have to call for the Messiah to return. Then we will see him again. And this is exactly what the prophet Zechariah tells us will happen. Zechariah 12:10. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication so that they will look on me. Okay, God is talking. They will look on me whom they have pierced. Israel has pierced God. How did that happen? Here's a mystery. And they will mourn for him? Who's him? It doesn't say they will mourn for me. They'll mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. And they will weep bitterly over him, like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. Who is this that's pierced? Who is this him? Well, the conundrum is solved when we realize that the God who is pierced, God who was pierced, he was pierced when he, the second person of the triune God, took on the incarnation, became a man, and came as our Messiah. We'll weep bitterly over him and mourn for him and beg for him to return to us. And Zechariah 13:8-9 also reiterates this position. It will come about in all the land, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish. This is the tribulation holocaust. It's going to be twice as bad as the World War II holocaust. Two parts in it will be cut off and perish. 66% of the worldwide Jewish population will perish during the tribulation holocaust. But the third will be left in it. One third will survive. And I will bring the third part through the fire, refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. And they will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people, on me. And they will say, the Lord is my God. You see the themes that flow through all of this? And so we now come to stage 8, the second coming of Messiah. We cry out for the Messiah to return, and he answers our cry. And the initial point of the second coming in glory and in wrath and in victory is Basra in Edom, southern Jordan. Isaiah saw this as well. Isaiah saw this in Isaiah 37, verses 1 through 7. Draw near, O nations, to hear. Listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, his wrath against all their armies. See, all the armies of the Antichrist. Every nation on earth contributed to his military machine. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out. Their corpses will give off a stench. And the mountains, notice this happens in a mountainous area, Mount Seir mountain range. The mountains will be drenched with their blood, and all the host of heaven will wear away. And the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their hosts will also wither away as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. For my sword is satiated in heaven. There's the second coming. When the Lord comes from heaven, the sky is rolled up like a scroll. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom, southern Jordan there, and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction, the armies of the Antichrist. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. The armies of the Antichrist are pictured as sacrificial animals. For the Lord has a sacrifice where? In Basra, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen will also fall with them, and young bulls with strong ones, lest their land will be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. The Lord will trample the armies of the Antichrist. Isaiah saw this as well, Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, the 63rd chapter. Isaiah is standing in Jerusalem looking south, and he sees a magnificent figure approaching Jerusalem. He asks the question, who is this who comes from Edom, whose garments of glowing colors from Basra? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. The majestic figure answers, it is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. That's the Messiah, folks. Then Isaiah asks the second question. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads the winepress? The magnificent figure announces, I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood has sprinkled my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart. My year of redemption has come. Folks, remember, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, is also Jesus the mighty warrior. Don't leave that part out of his character. He is also a mighty warrior. I looked, and there was no one to help. I was astonished. There was no one to uphold. So my own arm worked salvation for me, and my wrath upheld me. See, he's the good shepherd. The shepherd is tender toward his sheep, but he can take on a lion and a bear if he needs to. David did. Gentle shepherd, mighty warrior. That's our good shepherd. I trod down the peoples in my anger, and I made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. Micah also covers this in a couple of sentences. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. That's the one-third who survived the tribulation. I will put them together like sheep in the pen. The literal word there is Basra. I will put them together in Basra. Basra is Hebrew for sheepfold. Sheepfold. The sheepfold is a barrier with one entrance into it. In this case, it's Basra and the sick. Like a flock in the midst of its pasture, they will be noisy with men. Basra is going to be crowded. And here comes the Messiah. The breaker goes up before them. They break out. He's breaking the siege. They break out. They pass through the gate. They go out by it through the sick. So their king goes on before them, the Lord at their head. There's the Messiah leading Israel out in triumph, crushing the armies of the Antichrist. And then we also see this in Revelation 19, verses 11 through 21. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He is clothed in a robe dipped in blood. Now we know where that blood came from. And his name is called the Word of God. We know it's Yeshua now. And the armies which were in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. That's us, folks. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. As he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God, the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, Come, assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves, and small and great. And I saw the beasts and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. There they are, surrounding Basra, looking up, preparing to attack Yeshua as he comes down. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword which came out of the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. And that, folks, is salvation. All right, if you're curious about greater development of this position, I promised I would recommend a resource to you. I recommend the resource, The Footsteps of the Messiah, by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. It's available through Ariel Ministries. I believe it is also available on Amazon. I believe this is the best book on prophecy that I have read. I've been to seminary. I've been exposed to a lot of stuff, you guys. You know, you go to seminary, you get exposed to a lot of stuff. And I always keep coming back to Footsteps of the Messiah. It's the most complete, most consistent, most conservative book on Revelation that I've ever read. This is a commentary in the book of Revelation. It's a study in the sequence of prophetic events. A very, very important book you should have in your library. So I recommend it highly. All right, that brings us to the end of our session today, and we'll pick it up next session in verses 16 and 17 when we see that during the tribulation period, Israel will throw away her idolatry in preparation for entering the Messianic Kingdom. So we're glad you're here. We'll see you next session. Shalom.